Something I need to ask you, aliens and UFOs.
They put in together this exhaustive classified government document. I got access to that document, 100% real solid object. Dave is now convinced that what he saw was not of this earth. I can't tell you how many times in my life I've been at a certain point on a project and been like, this is stupid. I'm done with this. I'm going to go do something else. And then I thought, you know what? If you can land on a ship at night, you can do anything.
This is your host, Ken Arcega. Welcome to the Manceptional Podcast. Today, we have a really cool episode. We're going to speak with Francesco Paco Chierici. He is a Navy pilot, also a current commercial pilot. He has also written and produced a film and is also writing a novel. So we want to talk about all those things. As I understand, he started out at Boston University, went through ROTC, and then went into the Navy. And Paco, great to have you on the podcast.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, cool. So I wanted to ask you something that's a little bit topical. Obviously, I want to get into the background and see, you know, how you got into this whole thing. But the big news story, recent news story about the Southwest flight, it was a 737. I don't know what model, but that happens to be the type of plane that you currently fly. Did you have any thoughts on the, it was a blade failure, as I understand. I don't know if your particular, what you fly is the same model with that same engine.
I can't remember exactly what engine they're using at Southwest. I mean, I would imagine that they're all basically the same, but yeah, it was a blade failure on one of the compressor blades. And obviously it had a catastrophic, result.
Right. Is that, I think it was a C, I wrote it down, CFM. Does that sound familiar?
Yeah.
Different. Yeah. Okay.
That's that's an engine consortium between, I think, GE and one of the French engine producers.
Right. Right. So did that have any effect on what you are flying in particular? Like, do you know if it's the same model?
I think we have GE engines at Delta. I don't know specifically, but yeah, I don't think we fly with those exact engines. But, you know, I mean, that kind of thing can happen to any, although it's incredibly rare, it can happen to any, turbine engine. They all spin at, 14,000, 15,000 RPM. And, anything that's produced can fail, even though it's super rare, less than one in a million.
Wow. Okay. Have you yourself had any type of, anything similar to that, or maybe not that catastrophic, but something where something was going wrong and you had to overcome that? I'd like to ask you that on your military side, but what about on the commercial side?
No, on the commercial side, it's incredibly safe. I mean, I've been flying for 21 years as a commercial airline pilot, and I've really never had a significant maintenance or, any kind of other kind of emergencies. There's all kinds of little things that happen that, that you have to deal with, lights that don't work or some sort of failure on the ground that has to be dealt with. But I've never had anything that, is remotely dangerous.
What about that whole lithium battery thing that was a big deal for a while where the batteries were exploding in the cargo bay?
Yeah, no, it's still a big deal. I mean, the company, and I'm sure all companies are the same, but we've amended the way we have our practices so that people bring the lithium batteries into the cabin, and we have a procedure to grab that battery with these special gloves and throw them in a special bag, and obviously land as soon as possible. But
isn't that anybody with a computer or a cell phone? I mean, they're all lithium batteries.
Are they all lithium batteries? I don't
believe,
know.
I believe so. Or I thought so.
Ads. Yeah. I think, it was something that popped up a few years ago, and it seems like it's sort of settled down. It hasn't been much of an issue lately.
Okay. And then what
but
about
there is,
Okay.
It did change the way we do business in terms of dealing with batteries and having people be aware of where their batteries are.
Okay. And then what about the, I know we're on the commercial side here, but what about the safety issues as far as terrorism and all that? Has that been all settled down in terms of procedure and locking the door and all that type of thing?
Well, I can't talk a lot about that because, believe it or not, there is actually some, you know, there's, we don't want everybody to know all of the procedures.
Yeah. I mean, don't reveal something that's going to, you know.
So, you know, it's a multi-layered approach to commercial air safety. And again, you know, 9/11 changed everything. Top to bottom, it changed the way we do business inside the airplane. It changed the way the company does business. It changed the way the government looks at passengers, both domestic and international. It changed the way all bags are screened that are loaded onto the airplane. And obviously, everybody's familiar with TSA, TSAs.
Sure.
One layer and the layer that people see the most, but there are multiple layers involved in trying to keep airline flights safe. You know, air marshals on, you know, a certain percentage of flight, there's a certain percentage of air crew pilots that are armed.
Okay. And then that's good to hear. I'm happy to hear that.
Yeah. And then there's, you know, the locked doors, the bulletproof doors, there's, you know, different procedures, you know, before 9/11, which, you know, is a long time ago now. Before 9/11.
It seems like yesterday, though. I remember exactly sitting in my car on the freeway up in Silicon Valley going to work and hearing that, but
I remember, but you know, all the hijackings were they were a ploy to get the plane to go somewhere and to, you know, garner attention. Since 9/11 or at least that moment was transitional, because the plane hijackings were specifically to create weapons, right? It wasn't to go to Cuba or, you know, Beirut or something like that and get some press for your movement. It was to get press for your movement by killing as many people as possible and using weapons. So, you know, back in the old days, pre 9/11, if you had a hijacking, you would talk to them. If they wanted to come in the cockpit, you'd say, sure. And, you know, you would do whatever you could to sort of diffuse the situation. After that, if there's a commotion in the cabin, you got to lock the cockpit down. You know, you got to bolt it in. And, you know, you can imagine that there are circumstances where, and, you know, that would be a horrible thing. But, you know, you got to, for the greater good, you got to make sure that the airplane is not used as a weapon. So, you know, you bolt the cockpit door closed and then you land as soon as possible.
Well, not only that, but I mean, if the pilots are compromised, everybody could go down. Let's say, you know, not even just taking it somewhere, using it as a weapon, but if, right, something happens to the pilots, the whole thing goes down. That doesn't make any sense. So you've got to make sure that at least they can fly, and then whoever's in the cabin has got to deal with what's going on in the cabin.
Yeah. But you know, those terrorists, they went to school. They learned how to fly. I mean, not fully, but well enough, right? They took over the airplanes. And then, you know, the passengers are different now than they were then. If somebody tried to do that same thing again, there would be a huge passenger rebellion. And, you know, the flight attendants are more adept at dealing with that kind of circumstance, you know, in a more aggressive way. Right. So if you were on an airplane and you saw some guy get up and say, we're taking over this airplane, you know, you wouldn't, back in the day, you'd sit there and go, God damn it, now we got to go to Cuba or whatever. But now you'd think, okay, if we don't take this guy out, we're all dying. So let's go. Let's go get him. So the reaction of the passengers. And I have a very good friend who is on one of the United planes, or the United plane that hit the Twin Towers. He was in the back as a passenger. And he was a big guy. He played football in college. He was a Rio in one of the fighter squadrons in Miramar.
Oh, he was one of your Navy pilot buddies.
Yeah, he wasn't a pilot. He was a backseater, but he's a, like I said, a big guy. He's about my height. I'm 6'3". He was maybe an inch or two taller and like 40 pounds bigger with muscle. Jeez. And a really sort of aggressive guy in a good way, like in the way that you would want a football player to be aggressive.
Right.
And I guarantee you, if he had any inkling of, you know, what his fate would have been, that guy would have gotten up and just started taking people out.
Right.
So, you know,
what do you think? Oh, go ahead.
I'm just going to say things are different now, just to sort of tie it up. You know, it's a totally different environment. And I don't think that exact method could be used again to cause havoc. But to really tie it up, you know, you started talking about the security measures on commercial flights. And like I said, there are so many layers involved that people don't see. And 90% of it people don't see. They only really see TSA. Mm-hmm. And TSA is...
Unfortunately, in my estimation. Right. Yeah, I think they should... I don't know. I don't know all the details, but I think they should privatize and get a little more, get sharper people. That's just my opinion.
Yeah. I'm not going to comment on that. I mean, sure. Yeah.
Understood. So flying, I have a question for you. So I've ridden my motorcycle on the track. It only goes about 135, but I've got no fairing on it. And after doing that and getting that sensation of speed, it's not obviously equivalent to you flying your F-14, but still going from an F-14 down to a commercial plane, you know, is that similar to what it would be going fast on a motorcycle and then getting in a van going 20 miles an hour? I mean, does it feel?
Yeah, I mean, basically the only similarity between flying an F-14 and flying a 737 is that they go in the sky. You know, there's nothing about those experiences that are really similar or relatable. But it's a pleasant job. I like the job. Obviously, it's challenging in different ways.
Okay.
And like the highs aren't as high and the lows aren't as low. Obviously, the best commercial airline flight is one that for the passengers is completely uneventful, right? But you know, you, as somebody who enjoys or was drawn to that profession, you know, it doesn't go away. So I flew in the reserves for another 10 years. I flew F-5s as an adversary pilot, as a bandit, to kind of keep that fix going. And then since then, I've gotten an aerobatic airplane. It's called a Yak-50.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I've got a bunch of really good friends who are also, you know, some former military, some that were aerobatic pilots and then decided to jump over to the other side. And we all get together pretty frequently and go dogfight in this. It feels very much like a World War II, you know, propellers and tail draggers and go out there and pretend to gun each other. But it's really fun. And there's a ton of G and you know, you're sore and sweaty at the end of the day after two flights.
How many G's does the Yak pull?
It'll pull more than I want to pull. I think it's rated to +9 and -6.
Holy crap. You mean, so you, 9 G's?
9 G's, yeah.
Holy crap. Now, how does that compare to like an F-14?
F-14 was only 6.5 and the F-5 was 7.33. So, but it's a different kind of G. So, you know, when you're carrying, you know, 400 or 500 knots or even 300 knots in the F-14, that was max corner was 300 knots where you could get.
How many miles per hour is that? In
the Yak?
No, the F-14, like you're saying knots. How many is it?
Oh, so one knot is 1.1 miles per hour. So it's just 10% more. So say 500 knots is about 450 miles an hour.
Okay. But how fast did the Tomcat go though?
It would go Mach 2 plus if you had a really brand new engines, brand new plane, clean, nothing on wings.
So is that like
the fastest I ever went was 177.
177.
Yeah. Mach 1.77.
Mach 1.7. Okay. So what is that? Like 1,000 miles an hour or something?
Yeah. So Mach 1, you know, Mach is relative to temperature and humidity and air density and all that kind of stuff. So it's roughly 700 miles an hour, just give or take.
Okay.
So almost, you know, not quite twice that, a little bit more than.
Wow. And so, what does that feel like? Or if you're so high, does it feel like anything? Because you're so high, not much is moving relative to you. So it
you wouldn't really know. When we were going that fast, 177, it was right at the edge of that plane's capability. Mm-hmm. And we're diving. So there's this specific profile to get a max Mach out of fighter jets. And we were flying that. So you start off a little bit lower in a dive and then climb, accelerating it at 0.9 Mach to about 37, 38, 39,000 feet, and then nose over to try and get the maximum Mach.
Jeez. Now, was that for combat stuff or is that just like,
No. It was just like, you know, let's see how fast this baby can go. My Rio and I picked it up, out of a maintenance depot. So it was a clean airplane. It had nothing hanging from the wings. It was the slickest airplane I was ever going to fly. You know, we had an opportunity to take it out into the area and see how fast it would go. And it went pretty dang fast.
when you were in combat, and you flew during the Iraq war.
You know, I flew in what's called Southern Watch. So, you know, there's Gulf War I and Gulf War II. And I flew basically my entire career was between those two conflicts, those two major conflicts.
Okay.
And even though it was a combat zone and I got credited for flying it, quote unquote, in combat, we call it getting green ink in your logbook. Okay. I was never in any actual shooting combat.
So for that type of thing though, you still have to be prepared, right?
We flew as if we were in combat. So, you know, we were issued sidearms, which you only do in a combat zone. So every flight I flew over Iraq, I had a weapon on my person.
Right.
And, you know, we were prepared if we, at any moment, and it happened to other people, you know, they got lit up by radars and, you know, they were, rushed at by MiG-25s. My squadron, in fact, famously, after I had left, they had some MiG-25s. The MiG-25s would constantly fly towards us in the no-fly zone. So the rule was you couldn't go fire at them if they were in the no-fly zone. But if they crossed the parallel there, you could chase them back down, even if they went back across it to the north. Okay. And they would toy with us and we would, you know, get all ready and get the missiles not locked up, but ready to go and the master arm on and point in their direction, hoping that they would cross the line and we could sort of fence with them. But that never happened to me. Okay. Some of my squadron mates, after I left the squadron, the MiG-25s came across the line and they shot missiles at them, but the missiles hadn't been armed up properly by the guys on the deck of the carrier. So they just came off and went.
You're kidding me.
Yeah.
Wow.
Holidays. Anyway, yeah. So, you know, there was a constant state of possibility that you were going to get involved in something, but I specifically never did.
Okay. So it sounds a little bit like there's cat and mouse games going on all the time, right? Like you're both
there
aware.
It's not anymore. You know, this was when Saddam was still in power. It was, like I said, between the two Gulf Wars. So obviously the first one, we kicked him out of Kuwait.
Yeah.
Boxed him into a no-fly zone that basically covered the central part of the country where Baghdad is.
Okay.
And so northern Iraq was patrolled by the Air Force guys out of Turkey.
Okay.
And southern Iraq was patrolled by the Navy out of the Persian Gulf and the Air Force guys out of Saudi Arabia.
Okay.
And during that basically 10-year period, Saddam was constantly sort of tweaking his nose at the coalition and flying his planes in a provocative manner. And every once in a while, somebody would get into a little skirmish. And you always were fairly sure that if something happened to your airplane or you had to, you know, an engine fire or something like that, and you had to punch out, you were going to be in deep shit. So.
Yeah. That's just the sidearm. Did anyone, that, you know, public information, you could tell, did anyone actually eject? And I think, wasn't there a pilot that ejected and was caught in Iraq?
Well, there was during the Gulf War. Yeah, there was a few.
All right. Okay.
Yeah. I met one of them, a Marine guy. He was beat up pretty badly. It was a Harrier pilot. But yeah, there was a few guys that were stuck in Baghdad.
How do you train for that? Because you don't, I doubt they would take a $38 million plane in training and have you eject out and have the plane crash. So how do you train?
Yeah, of course. There's an ejection procedural trainer that you go through once. It's basically like an ejection seat on a giant spring. And you sit in that and strap in and you pull the handle and it just sort of launches you, 25, 30 feet in the air. It's impossible to practice for an actual ejection. I mean, you're sitting on something that will explode you out of the cockpit, basically. Jeez. And it's this Rube Goldberg contraption where all kinds of things happen in sequence. You pull the handle, which actually first draws your shoulders back into the seat. Then it ignites the rocket motor, or some planes it actually pops off the canopy, like in the F-14. The canopy.
Yeah, I was going to say I would hope the canopy would be open first.
Well, some you go right through, like the Harrier goes right through, and they have the
stuff. What?
Yeah,
I mean you're sitting in your chair, and the thing blows up, and you go through the cockpit canopy.
Yeah, but so your seat extends above your head, and there's a blade on the top of the seat that would pierce.
Okay.
Yeah, it's not like your head smashes through.
Okay.
The helmets are nice, but they're not that nice.
Yeah.
I flew the A6 before the F-14. That you went through the canopy in the F-14, even though it was the same seat. Once you pulled the handle, the canopy was blown off. Different airplanes have different mechanisms to get the crew out of the cockpit as quickly as possible.
Right. Okay.
And the rocket motor fires. There's literally like you're sitting on a rocket motor. It's right behind you and it launches you out of the airplane. And as soon as you're going up the rails, these lines that you attach yourself to pull your heels in to the seat so that your legs don't flail in the wind.
Oh yeah.
A certain height and a drogue chute pops out and this pins fire and push you away from the seat. And now you're sort of falling, without the seat, but with the seat pan, because that's where all your survival stuff is. And there's a little altimeter in the contraption you're in now, which will automatically deploy the parachute at a certain altitude, somewhere around 14,000 feet, depending on the seat. And then, you can float, you can do normal parachute stuff, but if you've passed out because you were going so fast and you land in the water, there's these fittings called seawars, which as soon as they hit the salt water, they fire and release the parachute from the pilot. So the complexity.
Yeah, that's a lot of
sequence. Yeah, and they're all individual actions, right? That each part of that seat does its own job individually.
Wow. Do you know anyone personally that actually did it?
Oh yeah. I've known plenty of people that have ejected.
What do they say it's like?
They all have different experiences. It depends at the speed at which you eject. A really good friend of mine has one of the funniest ejection stories. He was flying an F-14 into, the Naval Air Station, Oceana, out in Virginia Beach. Mm-hmm. And, as they're coming around the turn, his plane lost all hydraulics. So he was unable to directionally control the airplane. And he's in the middle of a turn and there's a shopping mall on his nose. So he didn't want to
eject. What plane is this? What plane is this? F-14?
Okay. Yeah. And this is about 20 years ago. And so he used the power. It's got two engines and they're fairly widely separated, but he used the power to get the nose of the plane pointed away from the shopping mall. And then it started to roll uncontrollably. So his Rio, the backseater, ejected them both. And they happened to eject on the far side of the airfield, which is perfect. They're on the Navy property. Nobody got hit on the ground. Okay. They're on the far side where there's a bunch of trees. And it's, a couple miles away from, where the fire and rescue guys are. So the plane hits the ground, and then the Rio lands nice and gently onto the earth, and he's completely unharmed. And then my buddy lands in a tree.
Oh, man.
Like 50 feet up in the air.
Oh, my God.
And so he's obviously too far away to, you know, just release his parachute and drop to the ground because he'll hurt himself. And he can see the fire and rescue building. It's, like I said, it's about a mile and a half, 2 miles away. Okay. And he was just sitting there for what felt like, I don't know, half an hour, 45 minutes while the clowns got into their car and drove over. And he was sitting there so long that he started to lose feeling in his legs.
Oh, you know, Jesus.
The harness was cutting into his groin and he's, you know, the blood's getting cut off. And he's getting really, he's kind of an irritable guy to begin with. So he's getting really cranky at this point. And, if you could imagine, you know, like the clown music, from the circus,
right.
The ambulance pulls up and one of these young, probably 19-year-old, rescue men, super enthusiastic, jumps out. He's like, "Sir, I'm going to rescue you." And he climbs the tree and he's climbing out on the limb where my buddy's parachute is snagged. And he's yelling at him like, "No, don't cut it. If you cut it, I'm going to fall and hurt myself. Don't cut it. Just wait for a truck, like with a cherry picker or something." And the guy's like, "No, I'll get you. I can take care of you. So the guy starts cutting his, all the lines of his parachute. And then he falls and lands on the ground. The rescueman falls out of the tree, lands on the ground, and breaks his leg. So as soon as he hits the ground at exactly the same time that the ambulance showed up, and the guys in the ambulance didn't even bother with my friend who's still hanging from the tree. They, you know, drove over to this guy who's writhing on the ground in agony, put him in a stretcher, and then drive away. And my buddy's still in the tree all by himself, just pissed off for probably another half an hour until they managed to get a cherry picker out and drag him out of it.
Holy crap, man. Keystone Cops.
It was hilarious. It's just one of the funniest stories. But yeah, I've known that, you know, it's a dangerous business where the planes and the people are always operating at the ragged edge. You know, it's they're always pushing the extreme of what the planes can do, what the folks can do. So, you know, things happen. There's plenty of people I know that have crashed and, you know, passed away, unfortunately, and other people that have hit other planes or you know, had mechanical malfunctions that managed to eject. And
so that would that be like on the deck of the aircraft carrier? They like back into another plane, or what do you mean hit other planes?
No, it's called a mid-air collision. So if you're like dogfighting
while you're flying, geez.
While you're flying. Yeah. Yeah. And those, I mean, we could go on for hours and hours about those stories, but you know, there's a guy that was in my squadron, my adversary squadron, who was in a left-hand turn. And there was another guy who was flying straight and level, but he was looking to the right. So they didn't see each other at all because the guy in the left-hand turn, you know, was belly up to the plane that was coming.
So he couldn't see it.
And he never saw it. And like I said, the other guy was looking to his right. So he never saw this plane coming from his left. And they hit. And my buddy's left wing took off his vertical stabilizer. And neither one was sure that they had hit each other. They just sort of felt a really big thump, but they never saw the other plane. So until, you know, all of a sudden the plane started speaking to them, that they're like, "I'm not sure what really happened. I might have just had a midair." And they're two of the luckiest people I've ever met, you know, to survive a 1,000-mile-an-hour rate of closure, midair collision. And both planes actually flew back and landed.
So you mean to tell me with all the electronics and the speed and all that, it still, at least at the time, kind of comes down to you got to look out your window and see if someone's coming? I mean, that seems like kind of like Red Baron type stuff, you know, where you're looking around, like looking at the planes. I thought there was more automation than that.
Well, there's no automation.
Well, maybe not automation, but the radar or something that would tell you.
Yeah, well, I mean, the radar may have been locked up. I'm not sure. The plane that got hit may have had a lock on my buddy, but he didn't see it because he's actually looking out to the right. So the radar is down, you know, in front of you.
Right.
It's not going to talk to you. It's not like Kit, you know.
Right.
Although, you know, maybe the F-22 and the F-35 do. You know, they're the brand new airplanes, the brand new kids on the block. It's less than it used to, but it still happens, you know, and that's just in training. Most of the accidents happen in training.
Right. Is there anything that you've done since then that I know you talked about the yak fighting, but does that give you the same level of adrenaline or speed rush or whatever it is than flying the 14?
There's nothing that will ever come close to flying fighters in the military for me, in terms of, you know, excitement and adrenaline.
Okay.
It's impossible. You know, it's like, you know, the most intense experience that you can have. And then going from that to anything is mundane after that. I mean, right. you were talking about a track day. I just took my car out to Laguna Seca yesterday for a track day with a bunch of other guys. And it's super fun, you know, trying to pass the guy ahead of you and trying not to let the guy behind you pass you. And, you know, you're driving your car around the track, a world famous track. I love that Laguna Seca.
I've been on there once. Yeah.
It's fun. Oh, so great. And it's awesome. I mean, I had a huge smile and I was wiped out at the end of the day. And, but it's not even in the same, you know, conversation as going up and flying a huge air to air engagement with 20, 30 fighter planes out there.
So how did you get into this whole thing in the first place? Like, you know, before college, as I understand, you were in the Navy ROTC, but like as a kid, did you make, like, I used to make models of, ships and planes and all that stuff, but I never did become a Navy pilot. You know, at what point were you enamored with this whole thing? And
I don't know. I think so. You know, like you, I only made models of airplanes when I was a kid, but it wasn't like, you know, I've met people that were like do or die, you know, and in fact, I don't know if you're going to talk about the documentary Speed and Angels later on, but
yeah.
Those two kids that we did the documentary about, they both from the age of 10 years old knew that that's what they wanted to do. And they basically dedicated their entire lives to becoming Navy fighter pilots, despite, you know, all the adversity that was thrown in their way.
Right.
I was not like that. I mean, I was fascinated by planes and aviation, and, you know, I built all these World War II plane models. Mm-hmm. But it kind of receded a little bit when I was in high school. And then once I got to college, I needed a scholarship to go to school. So I had to, you know, get a RTC academic scholarship. And, you know, once I got in that world, I was always fascinated with the Navy as well. Like, there was never any question about going into the Air Force for whatever reason. I mean, you know, neither positive or negative on the Air Force, but you know, the Navy always just seemed so much more of a natural fit, way more cool to me. And once I got into the ROTC and actually got exposed to, you know, naval aviation, man, it was like love at first sight. I was really became very, very passionate about.
But so basically the initial driver was you wanted to get an ROTC scholarship to help for college. That's what you were thinking. And then,
yeah, I mean, I got in, you know, back in those days, you know, I came from a solid middle-class family, and my parents were like, so college, how do you propose to pay for it? And,
and you're like, oh shit.
Well, but it was just the way, you know, I don't think a whole lot of people, had their parents, I don't know, certainly not in the world that I grew up in, you know.
Are you from Boston?
No, I grew up in Rochester, New York. I went to
Rochester. Okay. I'm a New York person too, originally, right in New York City.
Maybe, you know, other people, it was just easy and their parents would pay for school, but my parents didn't have that kind of cash, and they had four kids, and they were like, so what's your plan for tuition? So, I, you know, if it weren't for that, I probably would not have applied for the ROTC scholarship. I don't know what I would have done.
Wow, but I did. So you could not have been a Navy pilot.
Well, not by that route. Who knows what would have happened. Right. But, I'm, you know, obviously I'm glad it worked out. It's provided me with a career and a passion and, you know, all those, a life. So it was obviously more than just getting a college degree, but it was great. You know, to be able to go to a top-notch school and not have to pay a dime was fantastic.
Wow. Did you, so was it right away? Did it click like, okay, this is what I'm doing with my life? Or you just thought it was cool and you're kind of going along with it? Or what was that point?
So, you know, as a freshman, there's all kinds of different stages in the ROTC of exposure to the actual military. So you're just a normal college student. It's not like going to an academy or anything like that. You're just a normal college student. And once a week you take a military science class. And then another day of the week, you have to put your uniform on and go march around with all the other knuckleheads. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like military light. You know, there's no, right. You know, they just want you to get a great education. You have to maintain a pretty high grade point average. And you have to take these naval science courses and you have to march around once a week. So it's pretty minimal, commitment really. And then in the summers, they send you off somewhere for a month. And my first summer, my summer of my freshman year, I went onto a frigate and it was pretty cool. I got to go to England and Ireland and stuff like that for a month. And that was, you know, I was 18 years old. That was really neat. And then the next summer, I went out. They do a thing where this is the summer after you actually commit to the scholarship. So they'll give you 1 year for free, basically. Okay. And it may have changed.
But just to see if it pans out so they don't waste too much more money on you if you're not.
Yeah, so you know, you sign up for the scholarship in high school or right after high school, and you know, they give you a scholarship, but you may or may not actually like the military. You may not be a good fit right. for it. So they'll give you 1 year of education with no commitment, and then you have to sign your contract at the end of that first year. And so once you start your sophomore year, you're committed. You have to either graduate with a college degree and a certain grade point average, or you're going to go be an enlisted person in the Navy.
All right. Now, at this point, you're not actually on the track to be a pilot. This is just
Navy. Yeah.
Great Navy. Okay.
Yeah. The Navy is different from the Air Force. In the Air Force, you can get a pilot slot before you even go to college. In the Navy, you know, you don't find out till like March of your senior year. So, okay. But anyway, so that in that summer, after your sophomore year, now that you're committed, they'll send you out for that month. You get to go 1 week with a ship, mm-hmm. they call it the Surface Navy, and then 1 week with a submarine, and then 1 week with an aviation unit, okay. and 1 week with the Marine Corps, because that's the Marines are part of the Navy. They're under the right. Department of the Navy. So if you're in a Navy ROTC scholarship, one of the choices you have is to be a Marine.
Did you ever go to Great Lakes?
No, that's boot camp stuff. No, I was
okay. Yeah. I had to go to Great Lakes. I went in the Naval Reserve.
All right.
I ended up switching over to the National Guard for officer candidate school, but I went to the Naval Reserves. Went to Great Lakes for 2 weeks, and it was a pretty mostly. Kind of a sore, I would say half the group was kind of sorry, like, you know, older and not in shape. Yeah. And these kids with Coke bottle glasses are like 18, were walking around. They thought we were Navy SEALs. I was laughing because you were older.
Right.
Yeah. Anyway, that's my Great Lakes story.
Well, so just to finish this up, I got, during my aviation week, I got assigned to an F-14 squadron.
Oh.
And I actually got a ride in an F-14 at Miramar in San Diego. And it was a Wednesday night, so we got to go to the club that night. And Wednesday night was the big night at Miramar. And it was just freaking awesome. You know, the flying in the F-14 was awesome. Going to the club on a Wednesday night was awesome. I mean, it was like...
Was it like Top Gun? Was it like Top Gun? Did you...
So Top Gun came out the year after that.
Okay. All right.
And in fact, the guy who flew me on my flight was the aerial coordinator of the movie Top Gun. So
awesome.
Yeah.
When that movie came out, just going a little tangent here, how accurate was it, or did it give you the feeling that you had?
It's not accurate really in any way. there's nothing about it that's accurate other than, you know, they're flying at 14s and they're wearing
plates. I'm sure a lot of people went into wanted to be Navy pilots because of that movie. And you're saying,
yeah, it's, like, oh, I'm sure. It's not, I mean, it's no, there's nothing about it, but, it's fun. You know, it's such a hokey movie, and looking back on it, it gets hokier with every day, but it was fun at the time, and it was revolutionary, and everybody, you know, went berserk over it, and it was a lot of fun.
But you guys do have the call names, right? Like your
call signs. But yeah, that's awesome. Gone back. You know, that's pre World War II. They started doing that.
What was your call sign?
I never got one because
what?
I know my nickname that I've grown up with my entire life is Paco. I got it literally at birth, basically. Everybody in my family calls me that, from my grandmother on down. And when I got in the Navy, you know, there were like 30 aborted attempts to give me a call sign. None of them ever stuck.
It never stuck. That's so funny.
And I was like, come on, man, give me a call sign. I want something cool, like, you know, turd head or whatever, you know?
Right.
And nothing ever stuck. And I just kept, people would just end up calling me Paco. Obviously not my real name, but close enough.
Right.
So I basically never got a call sign. And believe me, I did enough stupid stuff to warrant one. It just never stuck.
What about your, you're calling him your Rio, the rear seat guy.
Yep.
Did he have a call sign?
Yeah, everybody had call signs.
Everyone. Except for Paco.
Well, I mean,
Paco was your call sign.
It was, but it wasn't, you know, it's what I was always called.
Right. So
yes, Paco was my call sign. Everybody had a call sign. And the cool thing about naval aviation as a military unit is that it's very hierarchically flat. So you could be the admiral of the strike group, and you could be the brand newest pilot in the squadron. And when you're flying, you call everybody by their call sign, because that's the most efficient way of communicating. You know,
that's cool. That's really
the admiral's call sign is, you know, not so smart. You say, hey, not so break left. You know, you wouldn't say, Admiral, I request that, I suggest you turn to the left. So it's just a very efficient way of communicating.
That's
and,
cool.
You know, whoever has the most situational awareness at the time is in charge of the moment, right? So if you're in a flight with the Admiral and you're the brand newest guy and you're vectoring on some bad guys and the Admiral doesn't have a radar picture, you as the new guy, you're in charge. You're directing, you know, a 30-year veteran. So it's a pretty cool, it's very flat in terms of the leadership structure within the squadron life and certainly in the air.
Okay. Did you have any mentors when you were going through, or is it like, I guess, would that just be your instructors, or were there's like, did you have any special mentor in any of this?
That's an interesting question. So, you know, there's certainly people that you admire and hope to sort of emulate. Mm-hmm. For sure. I don't know that I would call them mentors. You know, the naval aviation at the time, and perhaps still, I don't really know. I've been out of it for, you know, a decade now. But it was very much a sink or swim atmosphere. So you had to be, you know, on your game. You had to sort of carve your own path. There was no hand holding. Mm-hmm. You had to, you know, carry your own weight 100%. And I loved that.
You mean in terms of there's probably a lot of mathematics and studying and electronics. You have to probably know a lot of things for one. Is that what you mean by you're basically on your own to master all of that? They give you the materials, but.
No, I mean everything. Yeah. I mean, certainly academics, you have to, you know, they give you piles of books or, you know, towards the later stages of my career, we were doing computer-based training and like, okay, go and learn this thing and come back when you're ready. You've got, you know, 2 weeks. But, you know, not that there wasn't class, there was classroom, you know, environment and, you know, instructor pilots that are up there teaching. But in terms of like mentorship, you know, and I, maybe I'm putting too much into the word, a mentor, somebody who you'd like sit down with once a week and chart out the course of your career and how things are going. There was really none of that. I mean, it was sort of mentorship by osmosis, there's definitely some people that I looked up to and I was like, that guy has got his shit together. I want to do what he's doing and I want to do it the way he's doing it.
Right.
So it wasn't like that sort of a formal mentorship.
What about advice someone gave you? I guess there's institutional advice, keep your head down, don't talk back, or, was there anything like that, that stuck with you?
it was constantly. So, in naval aviation, we call it motherhood. If you
motherhood.
Take somebody and you, and that was almost a negative thing. Like, hey, let me give you some motherhood. Like if you needed to get pulled aside and spoken to, that was not a good thing.
Oh, okay.
It was, that meant you weren't doing your job. Somebody had to explain to you how to do your job. The world that existed there is not, I don't think, the model that you would want to emulate for corporate America or, if you were starting your own company. It was super competitive. Not in a way that you would put other people down. It was very cooperative, but everybody was competitive. Everybody was about everything, about how fast you drank a beer or, how good you were at, flying your airplane or how well you did on the, tests that we took. And all the grades were public, when you land on air. So, that just to give you a tiny sense of the crucible, there's 5,500 people on an aircraft carrier. And every single room on the ship has a closed circuit television. And, most of the time people, you can watch whatever. There's satellite TV and you can watch movies or you can watch whatever. But when there's carrier operations going on, almost every single TV is tuned up to what's called the plat camera, the TV camera that tapes, that videos all the launches and recoveries on landings on the ship.
Okay.
And especially if it's a really nasty night, it's dark and the ship's moving a lot and there's weather and, you're the last guy out there and or gal, and there's 5,000 eyeballs
watching you
try to land on the ship. You know it, right? It's super.
You got that Top Nugget Award for landing, right? So is that what you're talking about? That scenario?
Yeah. So when you all your landings are graded, there's five or six people out on the flight deck on this piece of the flight deck called the platform and the LSO platform, landing signals officer. There are other pilots that grade and assist you with landings. Ideally, they say nothing. If they're talking to you, it means you're sort of outside of the parameters of safety.
Okay, so they're giving you some motherhood, then.
They're giving you a little motherhood, a little sugar. Okay. But if it's a beautiful day, during the day, nobody says anything. You come in, all the planes stack up on top of the ship while the planes that are launching, get in sequence and then launch off the carrier. And then the planes overhead the ship without any communication at all, sort of funnel themselves into the pattern above the ship and come in and land. So if it's all done right, nobody says anything and 20 planes come in and land every 45 seconds.
Wow.
So actually I lost, you had a question about that. On my first deployment, when you're a first deployment pilot or RIO, I'm sorry, or NFO or Naval Flight Officer, you're called a nugget. That just means, you're a precious gem in the rough. You haven't been polished yet. You're just a nugget. And at the end of the deployment period, which is basically 9 months, you do a few months of workups and then you go on a 6 month deployment. They award the top nugget for landing grades. And I did get that. I was awarded that.
That's awesome. Congratulations.
Thank you. I had to actually land I was tied with some other guy and I had to land. I had an emergency, which failed one of my engines. I landed at dusk with a single engine and that vaulted me to the top. That 5.0 grade vaulted me to the top of the top nugget.
Wow. So did the engine, it went out on its own or it was a...
Yeah, no, it just failed. I was flying low over the water. And we were doing what's called rig and chip. So, you know, we go out and take pictures of all the ships within a few hundred miles of the carrier and everybody gets a different quadrant. And I was coming up on this ship in the middle of nowhere and my right engine just started going crazy. The noises coming out of it. I thought it was about to blow up. And I was...
Did you freak out?
No.
You're trained, so you just stay cool. Just deal with it.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of thing is not all that uncommon. You know, things go wrong in these planes, certainly more often than they do in airliners. You know, they're operating at the ragged edge, like I said earlier. So you get malfunctions and you get emergencies and fires and huge compressor stalls. It just happens. Right. So it's not, unforeseen circumstance. Anyway, so we're like 400 knots right on the water, a couple hundred feet, and I'm comfortable enough down there that I'm just like looking at my engine instruments while we're flying along, and my BN goes, "Hey, can you please climb?" I'm like, "Oh yeah."
Oh, they were freaking out a little bit.
Well, it was just him. There was one guy. He didn't freak out. It was just an excellent suggestion. You know, it's like, you know, whatever, nothing bad happening, but why don't we climb to get some, you know, safety underneath us. So we climbed up and we, you know, troubleshot it. And then we called back to the ship and told them what happened. And, you know, it was in the middle of the ocean. There's no other airports anywhere. We're in the middle of nowhere, 1,000 miles away from land. So we got to land on the ship. We got a single engine, which is no big deal, but it's hot and humid. We're in the Indian Ocean.
And isn't there air conditioning in the plane or the outside?
Well, I just mean the plane is air conditioned, but the environment. So jet engine.
Oh, right, right. Okay. And that affects how the engine works, right? And everything. Exactly. Okay. Yep. Got it.
And so, you know, we did all this math and then, you know, there's all these charts and tables and stuff. And they said, okay, you got to burn down basically all the way down to, it was 3,600 pounds of gas down to the standpipe. So as much
burn down. So they want you to have as less gas as possible. So if you crash, it's not a big explosion.
No.
Okay. Maybe I'm watching too many movies. I don't think they always dump fuel or something like
that. Yeah. No, you got the first part right. The second part was they want you to burn down as much gas as possible so that if you have to go around. So if you're coming into land and something goes wrong and they say wave off, that you have less gas to fight against, less weight to fight against to get back the plane back up in the sky. So it increases the airplane's performance.
Got it.
Okay. So we had to burn down all the way down to, you know, the standpipe. So, and that's not much gas. We're in the middle of nowhere. So there's no safety net. Like if we don't manage to land this plane on the ship, we're going to have to eject. But that's our job. Our job is to land on the ship in the middle of nowhere, even if you only have one engine. And so it was cool. It worked out perfectly. You know, it was right at dusk. So, you know, the sun was setting and, you know, the nighttime was coming on and it was nice landing, nice enough to get. So if you land, all your landings on the ship are graded. And there's a term associated with each grade, kind of like college grades or whatever, academic grades. A 5.0 is an okay underline and that, you only really get that if you have an emergency and land, you know, like really well. So I got a 5.0 for that. And like I said, that vaulted me into the lead for the top nugget. Nice. But, you know, an above average pass is called an okay, which always made me laugh. Like above average, it was like, that's okay. And that's a 4.0. And an average pass is a fair, and that's a 3.0. And then you start, you know, getting into below average, no grades and bolters and stuff like that. And cut pass is a 0.00.
Right.
So they're all graded. And then in each ready room, which is, you know, the communal workspace on the aircraft carrier for all the squadrons, each squadron has their own ready room. In each ready room, there's a big board up there with everybody's grades, you know, like your name and all the colors associated with your landing grades are all posted up on that board. So you can see, everybody can see, you know, they walk into your ready room, you're like, oh, that guy sucks. That guy's doing really well.
Do they do that on purpose? Like, you know, they've done psychological experiments with, even with cockroaches where they, no, I'm serious. They make a cockroach, you know, run down a little channel, right? And then they do it where they have a whole bunch of cockroaches watching them, like around them, and they perform better when other people are watching them. Like they perform in front of a crowd. So are they just tracking information, or are they kind of doing that so the, you know, everyone's on top of their game? You got to be competitive because everyone's watching you. Like, is that on purpose?
I don't think it's, I think it just evolved that way. I mean, okay. I wouldn't give the, you know, that community that kind of credence. That, you know, just it's a 100-year-old profession, right? I mean,
people, okay.
Pilots have been flying off ships for 100 years plus now. Okay. And it just, it's evolved in that manner.
Got it. Okay.
To the point where it's just, you know.
So you kind of touched upon it a little bit. You were saying that the way the Navy, at least, you know, the aviation side does things wouldn't necessarily carry over to the corporate world, but are there any daily practices or mindsets that you have acquired through that experience that you think helps you now? And that would be, you know, our audience, we're always trying to find, we're trying to see how people carve their own path and things they picked up, some tips that might be beneficial to use in their, on yeah. that path.
Absolutely. And, you know, there are tons of people that have come out of naval aviation that have done extremely well in the corporate world. But, you know, I would say that the things that I learned that have helped me are you can always do more than you think you can, or you can always achieve more than you can, that you think you can.
Okay.
And that most of it is just, you know, perseverance. Like, if you really want to do something, if that's your objective, your goal, your passion, that's basically 90% of what it takes. You know, if you can conceive of it, then you're probably capable of doing it, you know, other than whatever, being some sort of an Olympic athlete at, you know, our age, but, within reason, if you can conceive of it, you can do it. And it's, you know, it's been proven true many times.
Was there any time, in your course of training, you know, we didn't get into too much detail on that, where you thought, you know, had a doubt and then you just had to stick it out? Like, I don't know, they put you in one of those gyroscope things and you passed out, you know, at 1G, yeah. You're like, oh, that's not good enough. I got to reach 4Gs or something. You know, do you have any story of that, or remember any incident like that?
Yeah. I would say so for me, the biggest hurdles came earlier, early in training, which is probably, you know, when I was going through flight school in the Navy, we had a huge washout rate. They don't do that anymore because it's not cost effective. There's other methods that are more sensible to weed people out before they even get to flight school or start flying airplanes. But at the time, it wasn't that way. You just kind of threw a bunch of people into the program and see who survived. And I just remember not being able to figure out how to land the airplane. So that, you know, it's super fast. Everything is really, really fast. And like I always tell people, anybody can learn to fly an airplane. But it's the way that, the military, specifically the Navy, does business and training is that it's incredibly fast paced. So, you know, you only have, 12 flights before your solo check ride, and then your 14th flight ever in an airplane. I had never flown an airplane before. Your 14th flight ever is a solo flight. You're all by yourself. And that can happen in like 2 weeks.
That's holy shit. So 2 weeks, you've never flown a plane, and this is an F-14 you're getting in?
No. This is in training.
My God. 2 weeks to fly a $38 million plane. Okay, so it's...
Yeah, no. It's a T-34 Charlie, which is, you know, not nothing. It's a, I don't know, $2-3 million airplane. And so it's, you know, the pace is just unbelievable, but it works great because it, you know, you're in it and you're every day is constant feedback, and every flight, every moment of your life is graded. And there was right in the middle of that, like, I think it was my seventh flight, you know, the instructor's like, just come on in here and point at the runway and flare it and land it. And I'm like, fuck, it's not clicking for me, man. I don't get it. And it took a while. I don't know. It was probably the moment where I was at my lowest in terms of confidence.
Okay.
And I really didn't know if I was going to be able to, you know, break through to the other side. Cause I had never done anything like this before. The sight picture to me was completely foreign. I had no idea what the guy was talking about. He was using words that made no sense to me at the time. Right. And, you know, for whatever reason, you keep at it. You keep throwing yourself at the problem. For whatever reason, two flights later, it's just like clicked, like, I get it.
Right.
And, you know, 2 days later, I was doing my solo, and I swear to God, coming in for my first landing, I was shitting bricks. But
I don't know. I wonder what that's like to be in a plane all by yourself. Now, are the T-34s, are they jets? They're jets?
No, it's called a turboprop. So it's a
turboprop.
It's
a okay.
Jet powered propeller engine.
Right.
It's a jet powered propeller. A jet engine spins a turbine that
spins a turbine. Okay. But still, you're in this machine in the air, and you've only been doing it for 2 weeks, and then you're in there all by yourself.
Well, even more intimidating. So like 6 months later, at the time there was two different airplanes for jet training. There was the T2 and then the A4, and the mm-hmm. T2 was the intermediate jet trainer. Okay. So 6 months, well, it would have been about 9 months after my solo experience in the T-34. I've finished up T-34s, and you get about 80, 90 hours in that. And then I flew, say, 100 hours in the T2, which is the intermediate jet trainer. And at the end of that, your graduation is you get to go out to the aircraft carrier all by yourself and land on a ship for the first time. And now I've got less than a whole year of flying, maybe a total of 200 hours, probably a little bit less than 200 hours of airtime, of flight time. And off you go, man. Go and land on an aircraft carrier.
Wow, that's kind of, I mean, I guess you got to do it sometime, but holy shit, you've got someone coming in that could crash into the aircraft carrier. They don't do it right.
And some of them did. Yeah. I mean, that's like I said earlier, it was a very sink or swim atmosphere. I have a close friend who was coming into landing. And I think I mentioned earlier, you know, planes land on the aircraft carrier during the day about every 45 seconds. And when you're a student, it's a little bit longer, say a minute, they'll give you.
But that seems like a very rapid pace.
It's super rapid. You got to come in. You got to land on the ship. They back you up. Your hook comes up. You raise your flaps. Some planes, you fold your wings. The T2, you didn't, nor the A4. But then you got to taxi out of the landing area. And literally, as you're clearing the landing area, the other guy's almost landing. I mean, it's that fast. That's the way they want it.
It seems dangerous. It seems like...
Well, yeah, it is dangerous.
Something goes wrong. Let's say, I don't know, your engine stalls or something happens and you can't get out of the way fast enough. And
the LSOs, the people I talked to earlier, they wave off that plane that's in the
ground. Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
So you're not just doing it on your own. You've got like this little support system. Okay. But anyway, a good friend of mine was coming around to land on the ship. He was second out of a flight of four students, and they were coming around to land on the ship for their very first landings. And the guy in front of him had, I don't really know whether it was a malfunction or he just sort of freaked out, but he stalled the airplane and smashed in the aircraft carrier and a huge explosion, killed himself.
Oh, he died. Yikes.
Oh, yeah. And my buddy is like rolling into, you know, what's called the groove right behind the ship. And he sees, you know, you can hear it on the radio. He's freaking out. All this stuff's going on. And you know, this person who he had spent the last year with, you know, was really close with. You develop, obviously, very tight bonds with your classmates.
Yeah, I can imagine.
You know, it's just a huge fireball on aircraft carrier.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's crazy. So you know, I'm sure it's hard to convey how intense all of those things must have been to get through. And then, you know, you probably have more experiences as it went. But how kind of the segue into what you've been doing now? We talked about the commercial airlines, but putting together your movie, creating, producing your movie. Yeah. And then we'll talk about the book too. But does any of this mentality, you kind of had the same mentality, like, I'm going to make a movie and I'm just going to do it.
100%. So, I mean, I can't tell you how many times in my life I've been faced, and I love taking on new challenges. I love it and hate it, right? It's always super difficult. You're creating a whole new challenge for yourself that you have no real structure around achieving. And so you got to both create a structure for achieving and force yourself to go after that thing that you really want. Okay. Instead of doing the same thing over and over again, where you have an existing structure. And it's probably not the best way to to succeed in life in some ways, you know, but it's the way I've lived my life. So I enjoy that self-flagellation. but I can't tell you how many times in my life I've been at a certain point on a project and been like, this is stupid. I'm done with this. I'm going to go do something else. And then I've thought, you know what? You're a pilot. If you can land on a ship at night, you can do anything. And so, yeah, those experiences have 100% informed my life for sure.
That's cool. So a little bit about Speed and Angels while we're talking about it. You know, it follows those two kids, as you were saying, that this is all they wanted to do since age 10. Right. How did you come up with the idea? Well, obviously, it's close to home, right? Because it's about being a pilot. But how did you get that all together? And, you know, what was the hardest part of getting a movie together? Was it writing it? Was it funding? Was it just getting the team together?
Yeah.
All the marketing? Above. All the above?
All the above. I mean, this is one of those things that we could talk for 3 or 4 hours about, just the film itself. But I'll see if I can condense it. So I was in my last few years flying in the reserves. And again, I mean, this flying in the Navy is something that becomes a part of you, right? It soaks into every fiber of your being. It's one of those jobs that, you are what you do, you know,
right.
You know, okay. A lot of people are not, and that's great. I mean, you know, you don't necessarily want to be a car salesman when you're not a car salesman, right?
But when you walk around, let's say you're walking around, you're walking to the airport, even though you're a commercial pilot, you see your reflection in the mirror, you see Navy pilot.
Yeah, I mean, yes, maybe not as you know, on the nose as that, but yes, I mean, right. I mean,
you don't have a helmet that says Iceman on it, but
No, but I mean, internally, certainly, I try not to project that. I don't think I project that or broadcast that. But yeah, I definitely internally consider myself to be a Navy pilot.
Okay.
But certainly while you're in it, you are a Navy pilot. And you know, like I said, that is who you are. It's not just what you do, it's who you are. And it's something that becomes, you know, you can't be really a Navy pilot and not be super passionate about it. There's no accidental fighter pilots. Right. I was getting towards the end of my flying career in the Navy and, you know, thinking about it a lot, and what it meant to me and how to hang on to that story and that passion and to be able to share that with others, because, you know, it's, as we're doing today, you know, there's so many questions. There's, everybody has a question about that world and how it works and, you know, what are the true, intimate aspects of being a pilot in the Navy. And I love telling stories. I'm a storyteller by nature. And, so I came up with the idea, and I had written a screenplay, you know, sort of, for lack of a better term, Top Gun 2. Mm-hmm. And it obviously didn't go anywhere. And I got frustrated with that process with, you know, I'd had multiple meetings and lunches and, you know, whatever, lots of smoke.
So you're based now in Silicon Valley, but were you coming down to Hollywood?
Yeah.
That whole thing.
A lot. Yeah, okay. I had enough. I had enough interest in that film that, you know, I really did for a while think that it was going to get bought and made into, you know, a really cool naval aviation movie, but it didn't. And so I, you know, I got really frustrated, and I'm like, well, you know, I'm gonna make this. I'm just gonna make a movie. You know, I know what I want to say. What's the best way to tell, to make a movie and to tell my story and the story of this world? And I went to, ironically, Eric Zener, somebody who you've had on your show. I went to
episode number two.
Yeah, episode number two. I went to see a surf documentary with him. And I'm not a surfer at all. Eric is. But it was just such a beautiful movie. And the way that, you know, the people, the filmmakers were able to relay the experience of surfing, the way that you felt like you were actually on a surfboard experiencing the waves and the world and the culture, you know, it sort of crystallized the vision of what I wanted to do to tell my story about my world.
Right.
I remember walking out of that movie theater with Eric, and we went to see it during the day. So it was like 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I'm like, that's
it.
I got it. I have a path now. And that was, as it turns out, the easiest part about making the movie.
What, deciding that you want to make one?
Yeah, just having the sort of a conceptual vision as to the direction. Then I have a friend, Peyton Wilson, who directed it, who is a professional director, and that's what she does. And we have been friends for a long time, but never even discussed collaborating on any projects. And she is a very liberal San Francisco woman director, very much not in the world of the military. And so I pitched her on the project, and she's like,
doesn't exactly fit.
It basically has nothing to do with anything I'm interested in. And I'm like, just come out, just grab a camera and come out to Fallon for a week, or not even a week, a day. We'll just come on out and we'll shoot. And, you know, you'll meet some of the guys in their natural habitat. Cause she'd already met a few of them, but like in their world where they're wearing their flight suits and going out and flying. And she's like, all right, fine. So she came out and hung out with my squadron, my reserve unit, the adversary squadron out there, and just instantly fell in love with it. I mean, it's just such an incredible atmosphere. Right. And so together we came up with this strategy, and originally the documentary was going to be just about that squadron, because it's a very unique squadron. It's a, you know, like these ninjas of the dogfighting world that live in the, you know, live and fly in the desert, and that's all they do. And it's a very
kind of cool.
Yeah. Well,
that's your next
move? No, we made a really, really cool trailer like a sizzle reel for pitching, for raising money. And it's on YouTube. It's called Last of the Dogfighters. And it's okay. Actually
Last
really
of the
fun.
Dogfighters.
Yeah. Okay. And that was what that trailer, it's about, I think, 12 minutes long or something like that. That was what we thought the movie was going to be. It was about these like awesome dogfighting dudes that, you know, like dogfighting monks, that's all they do. As we began the process of filming the documentary, and there's a hours of conversation about how long it took to get permission from the Navy and, you know, raise money. I had to go out and raise money. We ran across the students that these dogfighters were going to be training. And to put it in perspective, so the dogfighters are like, I don't know, probably early 30s to mid 40s, older guys, right? Mm-hmm. They've been around.
Older, yeah. Yeah.
They've been around, and they're not that exciting because there's not a lot of change. Like when you tell a story, you want a beginning and an end, and there needs to be an arc to that story. There needs to be change. And these dogfighters, even though what they were doing is really cool and exciting, they're already established as human beings. They're already, you know, in that world. And they're living it, and they love it, and they're good at it, but there's not a whole lot of change.
Got it.
So we go down to Key West. Peyton came down with her camera and crew, and we're in the van going out to the airport, and we're going to be filming a sequence where, you know, the dogfighters are going to go out and fly against the students, these young 23, 24-year-old students. And Peyton had never met any of the students before, never. And she's sitting in the van to go to the airport. And she's talking to a couple of them on camera. And she's like, so what are you going to do? And these kids are freaking going out of their mind, right? They're 24. They're flying F-14s. They are so excited. They're about to piss themselves. And they are exploding on screen. I mean, it's, you know, when you go back and look at the video at the end of the day, you know, it's called dailies. You go back and look at your dailies. They were so much more fun to watch than the old grizzled veterans who were like, yeah, I'm cool. I fly, you know, I'm a bad guy. and these kids are like, oh my God, I'm going to fly at 14. It's going to be the coolest thing ever. You know, it was so much more fun.
So it was kind of obvious. It was kind of obvious. It stuck out that much.
Oh my God. It was instant. And, you know, all credit to Peyton, you know, I was like, no, we're going to tell this cool story about dogfighters. That's what I wanted to make a movie about. And Peyton's like, I'm sorry, buddy, but guess what? We're going to make this movie about, you know, a different form of passion in naval aviation, a form that people will actually want to watch because it's really cool and there's young kids.
You know, you know what's so cool about that is that, just to interject here, is that I guess, you know, sometimes you have to, you have plans of what you're going to do, but sometimes life happens.
Yeah.
Right. You got to be open to it.
Yeah. 100%. You got to be open to the possibilities that are given to you. You know, you jump down a certain avenue, a certain path, and just because you began on that path almost certainly guarantees you're not going to end on that path. But you do need something to get you started, right? You do need that. You know, and you can't be so married to that initial concept that, you know, that you can't recognize when something more special comes along. So,
right.
But you do need that, you know, that impetus to get you going in the right direction. But anyway, so she started talking to these young flight students and digging into some of their backstories and, you know, realizing that in the 1 year that they're going through F-14 school, you know, going from basically a freshly winged naval aviator to a year later being a, you know, fully fledged combat pilot in the F-14. Wow. You know, it's a remarkable year of their lives. They go from nothing to 1,000 miles an hour, literally, in 1 year. And that's
what you went through, right? I mean, so you could relate.
I could relate. I was, you know, obviously jealous of them because they were back in that really cool stage. I gladly switched brains. But they, you know, it became very quickly apparent that this was not only a better story, but a great story, a really, really awesome story of the pursuit, but the universal story of the pursuit of passion, you know, against the face of all adversities. And so we start off with about a dozen kids that we're following, and, you know, every few weeks we'd fly out to wherever they were going through training, either Virginia Beach, which is where they were based, or Fallon, which is in Nevada, where they were doing more air-to-air training, El Centro, you know, all these places around the country where they're going through this. Every couple of weeks, they'd go through some different phase of training, air-to-ground, air-to-air, you know, all this different stuff, and just follow them. We were able to whittle it down to, at first we thought it'd be cool to have an ensemble cast because they're all really interesting.
Right.
But it quickly became apparent that A, that was too confusing because everybody's wearing the same, you know, outfit. Everybody's wearing green flight suits and has short hair. To these two very, very, very special people that not only had phenomenal backstories, both of them dramatically different. Jay, the male, was shot in the face like right after he found out he was going to be going to the Naval Academy. He got shot in the face and the bullet went through his mouth and exploded his tongue and his teeth and got wedged into one of the major arteries that feeds his brain, one of the four major arteries. And, you know, he almost died that night on the operating table and, you know, just all these incredible strokes of luck. And so he almost didn't get into the Naval Academy. And then once he got into the Naval Academy, he had to get a special waiver that he had to fight for to be able to go to flight school. So before he even reached, you know, the crucible that most of us started at, which was flight school, he had already gone through, you know, incredible drama just to earn his seat at the table. Nice. And then, you know, as he goes through the process, he gets out of the F-14 training, gets sent over to the Persian Gulf. And within a week, he is in major combat. And we got it all on film. We got permission from the Navy to use the footage from his cockpit, and he's shooting his gun and dodging missiles and stuff. And it's insane. I mean, it's like a freaking Hollywood blockbuster movie. And you know, we just not stumbled upon it, but we followed him long enough that, you know, we had access to all this material. And then, the female character, Megan, she saw Top Gun when she was like 10 years old. She's like, I'm going to be a pilot.
Hey, there's Top Gun.
Yeah, you're right. And she's like, I'm going to be a fighter pilot. And her parents are like, okay. And nobody else encouraged her but her parents.
Well, that's cool.
But she wouldn't give up, man. And obviously, when she was, I think, in college, she ended up going to the Naval Academy as well. And when she was in college, they changed the law. So it allowed women to be able to serve in combat positions, at least flying at the time. Now it's more of an access, but at the time, they opened up aviation combat positions to women. And so she was one of the first cadre of female fighter pilots. And wow. And she was in the last class of F-14 pilots. She and Jay were both in the last and second to last class of F-14 pilots. And she, her story is a little more nuanced, a little different, but she is a constant source of inspiration to me. She had kicked ass.
Even now, like her story.
Oh yeah, absolutely. She's incredible. She had kicked ass at everything her whole life. Super motivated, really smart, really successful, really gregarious, great athlete, you know. Goes to the Naval Academy, kicks ass there, and gets into flight school. So just to answer your question from way back, in March of every year, everybody that's graduating from college and the Naval Academy gets put into one giant pool of, mm-hmm. you know, however many hundreds or 1,000 kids or whatever there are. And you're ranked by your grades and your other scores. Mm-hmm. And you just get to start picking. Like the number one person gets what he wants to do or she wants to do, fly submarines, marines, whatever. And you know, you just, it's 100% merit based. If you get down to your number and there's no aviation slots down where you're left, then you don't get to go be a pilot.
Wow. That's, yeah. That sucks.
Well, it is what it is. Right.
Yeah.
So she obviously kicked ass. She got into flight school. She did really well in flight school. She got into the F-14. And so she had done really well her whole life. And then she finishes F-14 training and mm-hmm. goes out into the fleet and has a huge crisis of confidence. Like she started getting some bad landing grades. And like I said, it's very public and everybody sees everything. And so she started to wilt a little bit under the
plus she's a female, so she's got extra pressure of like everyone's looking at me because I'm female.
Yeah, and exactly. And she got to the point, I think, where they were going to boot her out. She was doing so poorly. They were concerned about, you know, her safety, the guy in the back safety, the people on the flight deck. She was doing really poorly, and she did something I've never seen anyone do before. It's kind of like if you're a golfer and you get the yips and you don't know what's going on, you can't hit the club anymore, or you're like you're a batter and you got nothing, or you're a pitcher and you can't throw to the catcher anymore. You know, it's like when it goes, you don't understand why it goes. There's no physical reason why you can't hit the golf club anymore. Hit the golf ball anymore. And she was experiencing that same yips with landing on the ship, and it got dangerous, and they were very close to booting her out. And at one point, and I don't want to give away too much if anyone wants to see the movie, but there's a moment, you know, like a come to Jesus moment where she just sat down and said, if I don't unfuck my program, everything I've worked for since I was 10 years old is going to go out the window.
Wow.
It around 100% by herself. I mean, it's like, talk about pulling yourself up by your own bootstraps. It's an incredibly inspiring story. And, you know, obviously went on to be a Navy fighter pilot flying the F-14 and the Super Hornet. So.
That's awesome. Yeah. So I'm assuming she got her shit together, but that kind of goes back to your perseverance, right? You were mentioning where you have to have perseverance. About 90% of it is just sticking to it and doing it.
Yeah, just absolutely not giving up. There's, you know, in the darkest hours of your the voices in your head, the lack of confidence, whatever it is, you just put one foot in front of the other and you just keep going, and you will get somewhere that you are not currently at, right? You will go somewhere.
Yeah, I like that. That's great. That's something for everybody, no matter what you're doing, to keep in mind.
Yeah, and that, it's funny, like we didn't set out to make that kind of a movie, but that's the kind of movie it is. Right. It's a movie about perseverance in the face of insane adversity and how passion can guide your life in an incredibly positive way, right? Just something that you're so enamored with and so passionate about can move you forward.
Right. And, you know, that theme is something that's part of the reason why I started this podcast is for me personally to find my own, follow my passions, right? And that's the type of thing I'm hoping to convey to other people through our guests is
yeah, other people. For sure. I mean, I think that's probably one of the more, you know, not everybody in life gets to do that, right? You know, you have to be in a world or an environment where your circumstances allow you to follow your passion. Some people have to get up and, you know, go till the fields, and that's their thing. They've got to do that. Otherwise, their family doesn't eat. You know, but if you have the ability to let whatever your passion is sort of move you in a direction, then absolutely you should do that.
Right. Now, you went from Speed and Angels, this movie, you went to writing a novel, The Lions in the Sky, which I read a little bit about what it's about. It's an aviation thriller. Are you done with movies, or if you find something inspiring for movies, you might do that again, but you wanted to push yourself again and writing a novel?
I'm not going to say I'm done with it. Screenwriting is not my passion. I love writing, period. But I think for me, being a novelist or a writer is that secret dream that I never admitted that I had because I was afraid to fail at. And finally, you know, decided, all right, I'm going to do this. I know I'm a good writer. There's lots of people that are good writers. So to be able to, you know, create a story that has resonance and that has interesting characters and interesting plot in 350 pages is I think a really interesting challenge for me. And I wrote a great book. I think I've got a great agent, and I don't know where it's going to go from there, but I'm starting on the second book.
When does that, so is the first one out already?
No. It hasn't been sold yet. I've got a good agent.
Okay. All right. And so that's done, and there you're trying to get that published, and then you're already writing your second one, you're saying.
Yeah.
Okay. Got it. And did you go through the same type of issues where now you've got a new structure and you have to figure out how to execute? Or was it?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I'd never written. So I'd written screenplays before, which I must admit I didn't really enjoy. I don't like the whole screenplay style. But it's a long form written word. So I thought that it wouldn't be that hard to write a novel. I've read a billion novels in my life. Mm-hmm. Turns out it's actually really quite hard, at least for me.
That's easy to say, yeah, cool, and then to actually do it.
Yeah. So you know, you write a draft, and you're like, huh, this really sucks. It's absolute garbage. And then you got to figure out why it is, and invest the time into rewriting it, and then that's pretty garbagey too. And you keep refreshing the process until you get to something that's acceptable, and then you put the real hard work in to make it good. So it's every stage is a learning process. And yes, it was an entirely different house to build, an entirely different structure for a massive project that took many years to accomplish. But I'm so glad that I did it.
That's cool. Yeah. I mean, congrats on you actually completed the Speeding Angels. You made up you saw a surf movie and you said, I'm going to do it. And it's out there now. You can go look, you know, out there on Amazon, IMDb, and you know, it's
iTunes, baby.
iTunes. Okay. Is it on Netflix as well?
It's not on Netflix. It's on iTunes and Amazon.
Okay. So, for the audience, iTunes and Amazon. Man, you actually completed a novel, because I've started multiple times, and after 10 pages, you know, I just dissipated. So
I have it's a lot, man. It's not, like I said, it's easy to, everybody writes. Some people know that they're good writers. You can write an article. I've written a billion articles.
I read some of your fighters. Are you still the editor for Fighter Sweep?
No, I just did that on an interim basis to help my buddy out who owns that.
Okay.
Website. But I've written a bunch of articles for Fighter Sweep. Obviously I wrote a bunch of magazine articles that were published, and you know, I love doing that, but there's a huge difference between telling a story in a, you know, one page, five page, even, you know, 20 page story, fact based story, and then going and writing a fictitious book that's 350 pages long.
Right. So the book's not published, but iTunes, everyone look up on iTunes for Speeding Angels and check that out. Something I need to ask you before we wrap up here, aliens and UFOs.
Yeah.
So that was a big story. It's been in the news.
Yeah.
About your buddy. For those who don't know, why don't you tell it, Paco? Why am I telling it? You're the one that, it's your friend.
All right. So probably the best place to start is to point people towards that article. It's online. It's, if you look up, Paco Chierici, Fighter Sweep, the X-Files, or X-Files edition, there I was, it'll be one of the first article that pops up. But the story is, so I have a very good buddy of mine who I flew with in the Navy, and he was the commanding officer of a squadron, a fighter squadron, and they were going out to the ship off of San Diego to begin workups, the first stage of, you know, preparing to go on deployment. Mm-hmm. And the ships had been out there for about 10 days prior to the planes showing up, and one of the ships is an Aegis-class cruiser, and it's got this phenomenal radar. And it's at the time, this episode happened in 2004. And my buddy Dave shows up, and the guys on the Aegis class cruiser say, hey, we've been seeing some out here for a while before you guys showed up, and we'd love to get eyeballs on it. Will you go check out this spot? And he's like, sure. And that's basically all the information they gave him. And he and his wingmen are flying there, and they've got two people in their back seats. So there's four people. And they also, unbeknownst to Dave, told another guy in a single seat Hornet, a Marine pilot, to go check out the same spot. And they are, as they're transiting out to this latitude and longitude off about 100 miles west of southwest of San Diego, the Aegis class cruiser guy comes up and says, hey, what kind of armaments do you guys have on board? You know, what kind of missiles and bombs and guns? And Dave's like, nothing. This is a training flight. We're not over country. We got nothing, man. But that kind of piqued his curiosity a little bit, and maybe made the hair on the back of his neck stand up. And they also asked the Marine Hornet the same question, and his answer was the same, obviously. Mm-hmm. And so they get out to this spot, and Dave looked down over the water, and there was, it looked like there was what would be like a fuselage of an airliner, like a white oblong thing that was appeared to be in the water. And his first thought was, oh no, an airliner just crashed in the water. Let me go down and check it out. Cause it was the area right around it was kind of disturbed. And so he and the wingman start going down to go check this thing out. And they're at about, I don't know, say 15,000 feet or so. And as they start going down, this white oblong object, which he refers to as a Tic Tac, a white fighter-sized Tic Tac, starts coming up at him. And he's like, holy shit. And the wingman kind of freaks out and she levels off at some altitude above them. Mm-hmm. And takes high cover. So she can look down and see both Dave and the Tic Tac. And mm-hmm. Dave is a super aggressive fighter pilot-y guy. I mean, he was like, there was no question in his mind that he was going to go try and rendezvous on this thing. Now, not that he was going to shoot it. He didn't have anything to shoot it with, but he was like, he was going to get right up close to this thing. So he points his nose right at it and it starts climbing a right turn. And he's going down in a descending right turn. And at one point he turns right at it and starts digging across the bottom of the circle, which is a classic, you know, fighter maneuver. Mm-hmm. And as he's bringing his nose up to bear on it, he's maybe a few thousand feet away. So, you know, he can see it clear as day. It turns across his tail. It tightens up his turn and accelerates behind him out of sight at a rate of speed that none of the four people in that flight had ever seen before.
So is he looking at it with his, when you're saying a few thousand feet away, he's looking at it with his own eyes, not through.
Yeah, this is 11 o'clock in the morning on a beautiful San Diego cloudless day. And, you know, a few thousand feet in the air is nothing. That's almost getting the guns range. Okay. So he could see everything. If there were details, he could see them. As it turns out, this thing had no wings. It had no visible form of propulsion. There was no engines or anything like that. There was no windows. It was just literally like a 47-foot Tic Tac. Hmm. And all four of them saw it, and the ship's radar saw it. And there was an E-2 airborne. That's a, you know, like an AWACS plane. They saw it on their broad spectrum radar. They couldn't get a lock on it, but they could kind of see that there was something there. Mm-hmm. And as Dave was, you know, trying to rendezvous on it, he was trying to lock up he had a helmet mounted sight. He was trying to lock up the radar, cued to his helmet mounted sight, and the radar wouldn't lock. So, there was some evidence of, jamming. And so I remember Dave told me this story like a year after it happened. And we were sitting in a bar somewhere with a couple of friends and he's telling me the story and my jaw is on the table because, you know, I've been flying my whole life. And, you know, one of the things people always ask you is, you know, have you ever had an emergency? Have you ever seen an alien? I'm like, no, I mean, I've had plenty of emergencies in the military, none of the airlines, and I've never seen aliens. And I don't know anybody.
Yeah, that's why I brought this up. I wanted to ask you, going to bring it up front, aliens.
Yeah. And I've never seen anything like that. Nor do I know anybody that has. But now this guy who I know really well, who's the CEO of the squadron, is telling me the story. I'm just like flabbergasted. My jaw's on the table. I'm like, holy shit. And there's a ton more to the story. There's more detail and a lot of it is in that article. But so it just sat with me for years and years. And 2 years ago, I called Dave up. I'm at the time the editor for Spider Sweep. And I've always wanted to write like a great article about this incident. So I call Dave up and I'm like, hey man, you know that story with the aliens? Do you mind if I interview you for that? Because I'm going to write this article. And he's like, well, it's funny, your timing is amazing because this government investigative agency literally just left my house. And they've been doing a year-long investigation into this incident. They interviewed everybody. They interviewed the ship. They interviewed a submarine that was in the area. They interviewed all the aircrew that were involved. And there was even more aircrew involved than the little bit I just told you. You know, the radar operators, they went back and interviewed everybody. And they put in, you know, together this exhaustive classified government document. Mm-hmm. And so I got access to that document.
Ooh, do tell. No,
it was great. I mean, I read over it for, you know, a couple of weeks and then I wrote the article and then I had to give it back. So it was great. I mean, most of the good stuff is in the article anyway, but.
So what is your, there were so many sensors, right? Different people, different machines, different sensors. So this thing, I guess we could assume that there's something real here. It's not just like a piece of light that someone's just playing around with some sort of light trick or something?
No. You nailed it. There's something that happened. I don't know what it was.
It is a real object. It is a real solid object.
100% real solid object. And I asked Dave, I'm like, straight up, do you think this was, you know, something from another planet? And he's like, I don't know. It doesn't matter. I know what I know. I know what I saw. I know what my wingman saw. I know what the two backseaters saw. And then he had some squadron mates that, you know, he landed on the ship and some other guys were going out and they had a similar encounter, although not quite as up close as Dave's. So there are multiple people, multiple sources of imagery, multiple radar contacts. There's no doubt that there was actually something there. Right. Now, what that thing was, I have no idea. I don't.
That's what sucks. I mean, why can't, you know, cause I'm open to the possibility that there's, could be some aliens or some other life, but why the hell don't they just, you know, come and go land on the White House and just get on TV, tell everybody what it is. Why do we have to keep seeing these things, but we never get the real picture?
Well, I don't know. You may not want them to come here. Who knows? I would say, are they ET or are they, War of the Worlds? You never know what.
Right. Okay.
If you look back at the human experience of contact with new civilizations, it's never pretty, right? The Europeans. Yeah. Tragically came to the New World and gave everybody measles blankets and killed all the Indians or the Native Americans and then evicted them from their land for hundreds of years until, that's a bad story, right? Do you know of any really great stories of some human interaction where both sides benefited?
Actually, I could think of some.
You could?
Yeah. So I might be getting this wrong, but like the Incas or Mayas or, all around the world, we see even the Egyptians, we see some sort of alien looking things in their hieroglyphics or what have you. Those always seem kind of peaceful. Like they don't show some alien looking picture, like lasering and killing everybody.
Well, you're assuming that there's. Those are influenced by, I'm talking about human against human. Christopher Columbus came to the New World and things ended up badly for the New World, right?
It's usually a clash. I mean,
I mean, like over. Alexander the Great went into Persia and things ended up bad for the Persians. Not that that was a, first contact, but, generally when one group of humans comes into contact with another group of humans, bad things happen.
Yeah, that's true.
So who knows? Maybe, hopefully they're enlightened and they come in peace.
Oh, man.
Fucking orgasmatrons or something like that. But
So let's agree there's definitely objects that defy any known capabilities that we have, at least, or at least that the government's telling us. And that's all we know.
That's all we know, yeah. I will say this, that Dave is now convinced that what he saw was not of this earth. So he believes that he saw something from another planet.
Wow.
Which is interesting. I mean, like I said, there's a stand up sober, well, not always sober, but like a military man entrusted by the government to be the commanding officer of a fighter squadron. He's not just some, crackerhead running around with a on his head. So he, it's interesting that he believes that. It hasn't really changed, but I stated in the article at the conclusion, it's the same as I feel now, that I don't know and I don't really care. If they want us to know they're there, they'll come. If they don't, then we'll just get teased for the next 1,000 years. And,
right.
It doesn't really matter. It doesn't affect my life yet. If, as you say, one of them lands on the White House and begins a discourse, then all of a sudden everything's different, right?
Yeah.
The course of human history is different. Until then, it's just, it's a new.
Yeah. I hear you. Paco, this has been awesome. I really appreciate it. What I try to end with, since this is the Manceptional podcast, men trying to carve their own path in life and man skills and the like, what would your thought of a man being manceptional be? Like, what if you were to think of someone, a mythical character of characteristics someone who is manceptional in their life, what do you think that would look like?
Wow, that's a big question.
Manceptional isn't a real word, you know. So
yes, I'm a writer, Ken. I know that.
You're a writer. Yeah. Okay. No, but I'm just saying I kind of made that up. So, you know, I realize it's not a real thing. So
yeah, no, I get it. It's, you know, there's a lot that goes into it. I mean, it's not an easy answer. You want somebody that, is, self-motivating, that aspires to great things, but also that takes care of, you know, the details, right? Takes care of people that are less fortunate than them. I think that's a huge responsibility to mm-hmm. anybody in anything that is doing well, is to, you know, make sure that those that aren't doing as well are noted and brought forth. That loves freely, right? You know, you want to be able to care for other people and other things in a way that makes everybody better and makes those people better. Mm-hmm. And that is, you know, that's able to leave the world a better place, you know, in all ways. It's a tough concept to really condense.
yeah. That's why I kind of throw it out there. It kind of makes you think a little. You know, I also think of, fatherhood. You've got children. And
for sure. Yeah, I've got kids. Kids change in a way that, you know, aliens do, right? But pre-kids and post-kids. The world is an entirely...
Some kids are aliens. Yeah. You know?
The world is an entirely different experience after you have children. But it's a good one. So yeah, to condense all of that into some sort of a useful phrase would be to not stand still, you know, not stand still and take care of the people that come on your journey with you, you know.
I like that. That's nice. That's a great way. That's a great way to kind of cap things off. If people want to find out more, well, obviously we talked about the movie, so you know, you can grab that on iTunes. Is there any way how would they find out if your book gets published? Like, how would they know? You'll go on Amazon, or like, how would they find out?
Well, it depends who buys it and how they distribute it and all that kind of stuff. But I'll shout it from the highest yardarm if I get my book published. Don't worry, I'll let you know. I don't have like a personal website right now.
Okay. All right.
If the book does get published, I for sure will have a personal website. So
yeah, I was going to ask, how could people contact you, but you might not want that. How could people, let's say, follow you? Do you have an Instagram, or do you do anything on social media, or are you?
I have a Twitter account, which right now is 100% taken up with all the UFO people that have been following me after since I wrote that article. I get the strangest freaking tweets and follows. But yeah, I mean, if you just go Paco Chierici Twitter, I'm sure it'll pop up.
Okay, fantastic, Paco. Thanks so much. This is a great conversation. I love the perseverance stories, because I think that's a lesson we can all learn, and then not standing still, and taking care of people around you, and I think that's a great way to think of things and to keep raising yourself up to be manceptional.
There you go.
Awesome. Okay. Thanks again, Paco. Appreciate it.
Yeah. My pleasure, man.
Okay. Take care. See you, man. Okay.